Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. You'll find an eagerness in the reporting from Iraq over the last few hours, an eagerness to report on the final push to Baghdad. We're hearing word now from Central Command that significant progress is being made in the move from the south. And along with these reports are cautions, again from the military, that the end of this war will not come quickly or easily. However, the recent military activity does bring us closer to one question, and that is, what comes after? What sort of administration will run Baghdad in the days, weeks, and months after the war? Well, there are a number of options. The first has the U.S. leading a military-civilian occupation for an indefinite period. Another sees a quick transfer to Iraqi civilian control, drawing on the resources of exiles and expatriates. And another option would have the U.N. taking a larger role in managing a return to normal life. No one seems to know exactly how it's going to work. The White House is playing this very close. All that's certain is that a team of U.S. administrators under the eye of retired General Jay Garner is waiting for its instructions in Kuwait City. Connection listeners, who should take the lead in running Iraq after the fighting stops? Should it be a neutral force like the U.N., or should America take responsibility for the reconstruction? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Before introducing my guests and getting to that topic, though, let's go first to Karen Sloan. She's a reporter with the Associated Press. She's joining us on the line from U.S. Central Command headquarters in Doha, Qatar. Hi, Karen.
Hello there, Dick.
Quite surprising advances we're hearing about today from the infantry division and the Marines. Is this more news than we've... This seems to be more news than we've had in a while.
A lot more news. Right before I made the phone call to you, I was talking with my colleagues, and it's like the floodgates of information have suddenly opened here at Central Command after they've been shut for quite a long time.
Now, does that mean that they have a lot to report, that there really have been real advances, or that they've just decided to say a lot more about what's been happening in the field?
I would suspect that both would be the case. I think that they felt that they've made sufficient advances in the field that they can afford to tell us more now without endangering operational security, which is always a very big concern of military commanders. And as well, they are making significant progress, it appears. On our wires today, we were reporting that forces are within 35 miles of Baghdad, although it's impossible to really pin down Central Command about those kinds of numbers. They just don't want to go there.
I understand, Karen, that puts them within range of what military people have warning could be any sort of weapons of mass destruction should the Iraqi forces choose to use that. Is that much talked about in Qatar?
Well, today was the first day, actually, that we had public reference to that. It had been something very much discussed in the media in the last week or so. But I had never heard a top general stand in front of us and start talking about the red line and the red zone. But General Vincent Brooks did that for us today.
Karen, just one more. The BBC's reporting that the U.S. military may have, that some coalition aircraft may have bombed a Red Crescent hospital in Baghdad. Any news at Central Command about that?
To be honest with you, in the last half hour or so, I've been busy filing my story, so I haven't checked back. But during the briefing, and last I knew before we went into the briefing, Central Command said they were aware of different reports today. They had actually been asked about that one at the briefing, and General Brooks says that they've heard the independent reports. They can't confirm or deny they're investigating.
Karen, thanks so much for this.
Thank you very much.
Karen Sloan is a reporter with the Associated Press, joining us on the line from Doha, Qatar. I talked a little bit earlier today with a fellow by the name of Colin Soloway. He's a Newsweek correspondent embedded with the 101st Airborne Division. Now, Colin's not allowed to say where he is, just that he's currently based in Iraq.
The big news around here, honestly, is the speed at which 3rd Infantry Division has been advancing. Last night, yesterday afternoon, they were a few kilometers south of Karbala. Today, they're probably about 20, 30 miles north of Karbala at this point. North and also east of Karbala. They've cut the main highways, leading between Karbala and Baghdad. So it appears that the tactical pause is over at this point, and 3rd Infantry is pushing forward.
Colin, a lot of the talk here is that the big push is on now. The Apache pilots that you're with, are they saying that that's what it looks like from the perspective where you are with the 101st?
Oh, yeah. I mean, everybody, information is sometimes scarce, especially when you're out at a battalion where you're out living next to your aircraft. You tend to get information when your commanders come in, but just looking at the maps, looking at the situation and talking to commanders, it's clear that, that 3rd Infantry Division has exceeded pretty much everyone's expectations. In fact, one of the problems for Apache pilots is that, and I know the folks I've been with have one of their problems is that the 3rd Infantry Division has been advancing so fast that, they've been basically moving forward so quickly that they're almost overrunning the target areas that missions were planned for. So we've had a couple of missions canceled in the past week, simply because 3rd Infantry Division was advancing so fast on the areas they were going to attack that there were fears that, that there could be a fratricide, that they could get mixed up between, the Rocky and American forces. And so the missions got canceled. So the deep attack guys are having, as of today, there's less and less deep to attack, in the Baghdad area as 3rd ID pushes forward.
Colin, thanks so much for doing this.
No problem.
Colin Soloway is a Newsweek correspondent embedded with the 101st Airborne Division. Now, if we can wrench our attention away from what's happening right now in Iraq and take a look ahead, as so many people are, at what comes next, I'd like to introduce my guests to help us with that. Jane Hall Lute is the Executive Vice President of the United Nations Foundation. She's a career officer in the U.S. Army, held command during the Persian Gulf War. Also with me is Daniel Serwer. He's Director of the Balkans Initiative at the U.S. Institute for Peace, former U.S. Special Envoy for the Bosnian Federation, for which he negotiated the first agreement reached at the Dayton Peace Talks. They're both joining me from the Christian Science Monitor studio in Washington. Welcome to The Connection.
Good morning.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Daniel, let me start with you. How much do we know about what's planned for what comes after? I mean, casting around the newspapers and magazines, it seems like there's so many contradictions. Do you have some information? I don't.
I do have some contact inside the apparatus that's doing some of this planning in Kuwait. I don't think I have a complete picture of what they're planning, but it seems fairly clear that they're planning initially, at least, for a U.S. lead. But I think it's very important to understand that in an operation of this sort, there are various phases. You don't just start with something and stick with it. Mm-hmm. I think there's no alternative to the U.S. lead. Public security is job one in the post-conflict situation. Power grows from the barrel of a gun, and we're going to have the most guns, so we're going to be responsible for public security. And that really puts us in charge. The question really revolves about what happens after that and how long Americans remain in an authoritative role over the governing structures in Belgrade. And that's where
most... Or rather in Baghdad.
In Baghdad, sorry. That's where most of the controversy is. It seems to me that there are legitimate differences on that question. I'm sure we'll get into them.
Jane, this U.S. lead that Daniel's talking about, military, civilian, is that all clear, or are you satisfied with the information that you have looking ahead?
Well, we've also talked with some of the folks who are involved in the U.S. planning effort, as well as those in the U.N. who have found themselves over the past dozen years doing this for a living. And we've also had extensive conversations with those in the non-governmental community who are increasingly relied on to provide essential services in post-conflict. I don't know that anyone has a handle on the single plan for post-war Iraq, but certain things seem pretty clear. Number one, force can't do all that needs doing. Number two, all that needs doing can't be done alone. And so while the United States and its coalition partners will have a clear role in certain areas, like the security sector, for example, as Daniel said, it's pretty clear that they're going to need the help of others, importantly, the expertise and experience of the UN in working in other areas.
In areas other than humanitarian assistance, is that what you're talking about?
Right. I think, for example, in the area of civil administration, while many people expect that everyone will be looking to a rapid transition to the Iraqi civil service and Iraqi, right, indigenous Iraqi political authorities, overseeing the management of that transition and then overseeing the reconstruction of indigenous political institutions will be one for which the UN, frankly, is well suited. In addition, there is the very special question posed by the oil and the oil fields administration and the restarting of production and quantity from those oil fields. And for that, there's going to need to be some other structures put in place other than the coalition powers, it seems to me.
Now, Daniel, you're not too crazy about the UN's record since the Cold War of doing some of these things like civil administration.
I am skeptical that the UN can act very quickly to establish governing authority anyplace. In fact, I doubt anybody can act very quickly to establish governing authority who doesn't start well in advance. And Jay Garner's team in Kuwait at least has the advantage of having started a couple of months ago. The UN can't do much on the governing authority question until after a Security Council resolution passes and it hires a chief of the mission and he tries to put together a mission. Now, under the best of circumstances, it takes that kind of UN mission at least 6 months to deploy. In East Timor, for example, it was a bit more than 6 months, and those were very friendly conditions. I think Jane is absolutely correct about humanitarian assistance, about assistance for refugees. I think UNDP will play a role in the planning for future economic development. I think there are all sorts of roles for the UN, but I think the initial governing responsibility has to be with the occupying power.
Be more precise for me, though, Daniel. Do you mean initial? Initial? Do you mean the first month, the first 6 months? What are you saying?
I think you judge that on the spot. I think the planning, if you read the newspapers carefully, sounds like it's planning for a transition to Iraqis within a few months. I think experience elsewhere suggests that that might be quite difficult. But we still don't know what we're going to find on the ground, what kind of ministries will really exist. In the south, in Umkasser, all the people who administered the oil for food program disappeared very quickly. Why? Because they were Baathists who were servants of the regime and they didn't want to stick around. So that structure in the south may not be as usable as people thought it might be.
Jane, just a quick word from you. What is it that the UN can do off the bat that you think that perhaps it's not being given credit for?
Well, I think in addition to the humanitarian assistance and addressing the IDPs and refugees, it can also play an important role in resuming the inspection regime to provide international legitimacy and for the identification and safe storing of the weapon stockpiles we all believe Saddam has. Mm-hmm. I do think it has the capacity to oversee restoration of civil administration by Iraqi authorities. And I think more broadly, it has the political legitimacy to begin to convene representatives for very much as it did in Bonn for the Loya Jirga in Afghanistan and put in place durable Iraqi institutions for the long term.
And, of course, that question of political legitimacy is something that changes over time. I mean, if the war were to have ended in a couple of weeks, that would be easier to talk about than, say, something that's going to last a number of months. That's probably a good place for us to pick it up when we come back after the break. Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Connection listeners, who should be responsible for reconstruction in Iraq? Should it be America, which led the war there? Should it be an international body? Should it be the United Nations? We'd like to hear from you. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Who is it? Which organization is it that's supposed to be putting Iraq back together again once we start reporting on the end of the fighting and those days of what comes after? Jane Hall-Lude is with us. She's Executive Vice President and Chief Operating Officer of the United Nations Foundation. Daniel Serwer is also in the same studio with her in Washington. He's Director of the U.S. Institute for Peace's Balkans Initiative. And Daniel, maybe you can start on the question that I posed at the end in terms of making a decision who goes in, whether or not it's guns that are important. I would imagine that would change a lot depending on whether or not it's a long war or a short war, and Baghdad is full of, you know, broken buildings and angry people or cheering civilians with sweets and flowers.
That's correct, and I don't think we're going to necessarily know until we get there and until we face the situation. But I think we do know that public security is the first priority in the post-conflict situation. You can't allow a vacuum. There'll be revenge killings if you do. There'll probably be revenge killings in any case. But you can't let that situation get out of hand. You've got to be able to restore law and order. And that's a job that I think really belongs to the occupying power in the first instance. But it shouldn't hold on to that job. There has to be a transition to civilian authority. It has to happen as quickly as is feasible and in as practical a way as feasible. I'm not against the UN playing a role. I only want to be practical about it and ask what the UN can effectively do and in what time frame.
Jane, do you have any reservations based on what we do know about this retired General Jay Garner, who's in Kuwait City, apparently has a team of people with him ready to move in and run 20 or so odd ministries with Iraqi advisors underneath them? I don't know if that understanding is what you have, but that's...
Right. Again, I don't think any of us have seen, actually, the plan that the U.S. has for post-war Iraq. Jay Garner, whom I do not know personally, has a reputation as a fine soldier and will no doubt discharge his responsibilities with great skill. And he's assembled a team around him who seems representative of the kind of skills and expertise and experience that are necessary. And, of course, we all need all the efforts to succeed, but there's plenty of work to go around. I think I would just return a little bit to this notion of, you know, the kind of peace as a function of the kind of war, being a function of the kind of war. I think that's really essentially true, as Daniel said, but I also think we learned an important lesson from the last Gulf War, and that is decisive victory really requires decisive defeat. And this time there will be no mistaking the defeat of Saddam Hussein, and that requires that he demonstrably be removed from any position of command and control over any of Iraqi resources. And the headlines today say that there's a demand now for unconditional surrender. But it will also require, you know, sort of breaking the back of the Ba'athist Party structure that permeates Iraqi society. And so while in the aftermath, and I think that these two features combine with sort of an unspoken imperative to keep the country together so that not fractionate and that opportunist exploit sort of the confusion and uncertainty in the war and the aftermath to make a break, as it were. So,
are you saying, Jane, that if the U.S. military is the organization that goes into Iraq and Baghdad and smashes stuff up, that maybe that's not the organization that has the credibility or the standing to then enforce the peace?
No, what I'm saying is, although some people do say that the U.S. will not have the legitimacy for the long-term political role that an occupying power would be asked to play, and here again I agree with Daniel that it has a role in the short and immediate term, but then should look to hand over to the Iraqi people and to international authorities as rapidly as is practicable. But I guess what I'm saying is that for victory to be clear this time, defeat must be clear. But defeat alone will not ensure a capable Iraqi society in a region no longer susceptible to the kinds of threats and menaces that Saddam Hussein and his regime posed. It will take other kinds of work.
Daniel Serber, do we take any kind of lesson from Afghanistan, where there was a sort of a U.S.-supported administration quickly put into place there? Is that a guideline for Iraq?
I think the lesson is a different one, that if you don't establish public security, any group that you install in power is going to have a very difficult time executing power throughout the entire country.
And that's what you think is happening in Afghanistan even today.
Yeah, I think that's what's happening in Afghanistan. There are maybe good reasons. We were still after Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. But the fact is that Afghanistan is not a good example of establishing governing authority beyond just having formed a government that governs in Kabul. The fact is that a good part of the country is out of control of that government. And this is what we cannot allow to have happen in Iraq. In Iraq, the Ba'ath Party structures, as Jane suggests, have to be smashed. They have to be prevented from doing what such structures normally do in these situations, which is that they will reorganize themselves as organized crime. And this is very much what happened in Serbia. It's resulted fairly recently in the assassination of a Serbian prime minister. Because too much of the old structures were left in place and they were able to establish control over resources, over smuggling, over cigarettes, and you ended up with an impossible situation and a pitched battle, really, between the government and underworld forces. We cannot have
Can I ask a kind of a stupid question here, Daniel? I mean, if there are a bunch of people in Baghdad who perhaps they have relatives who were in the army and are killed, perhaps they, you know, were, you know, had a friend or a relative in a marketplace who was killed, and so those people in that capital city blame the Americans for wreaking havoc on their country. Doesn't it make sense under that kind of argument to pull together some kind of international force rather than having the Americans there as sort of continued targets for whatever kind of retribution there might be against Americans?
It would be an argument if we didn't have vital interests in how Iraq is run. We turned over Kosovo fairly quickly on the civilian side to a UN governing authority, and the reason for that is that we didn't have such vital interests there. I think in the case of Iraq, the Americans are going to be very hesitant about turning over anything they regard as really vital to U.S. national interests.
Do you mean the oil when you're talking about vital interests?
In part oil, but in part the smashing of the Ba'ath regime, in part weapons of mass destruction. I think Jane's correct that eventually the UN may have a role in monitoring weapons of mass destruction or the absence of them in Iraq. But in the initial stages, the Americans are not going to trust the UN immediately to go in there. They want to do this themselves because they regard it as vital to U.S. interests. So I think it's unrealistic to expect, having conducted this war without a U.N. Security Council authorization, that the United States is going to turn around immediately and give those who oppose the Security Council resolution a very strong role in those areas that the United States regards as vital.
We've got a number of people who are anxious to join us on the line. Let's take our first call from Virginia Beach, Virginia now. Sonny's with us. Hi, Sonny.
Hi. How are you doing?
I'm fine. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, Mike, I have just one comment. UN's leadership role in rebuilding Iraq should not be allowed.
Why?
Even if it is allowed, it has to be based on America's leadership and America's and the coalition's choosing. First of all, the UN has become an irrelevant body. America is a great leader today is because we have a great leader like George W. Bush. Leaders should lead all the way to finish the job of rebuilding, too. Otherwise, this war will not really be won.
All right. Now, Sonny, stay on the line. I'm going to ask Jane Hall-Lute to talk to you. She's head of the UN Foundation and might just disagree with your notion of the UN as an irrelevant organization.
Well, not just me would disagree, but which I obviously do, but the vast majority of American people would disagree with that. In a recent poll that we conducted in the middle of March, 78% of Americans said it was in the United States' interest to have a strong UN, that we should stay in the UN, and that we should actively support it. I mean, there's a very deep sense of that, the UN represents, in fact, in part, a creation of the United States and the community of democracies within which the American way of life is deeply rooted. This is an institution that has served our national interests for many, many years. But it also has a very practical role to play here, and it seems to me that it's in the interest of the United States to internationalize the burden of rebuilding Iraq. It can't do all that needs doing by itself, and in fact, it doesn't have to.
What about Sonny's point, though, that in this particular conflict, it ought to be up to the U.S. and not the U.N.?
Yeah, at least by this administration's own reports, it can't be the world's policeman. Force can't do all that needs doing if we're going to recover from the scourge of Saddam Hussein and the threat he has posed to his people in the region. Force has played an important part here. The president's made a decision to go to war, and we have young men and women in harm's way who are very deeply committed to each other, to their professionalism, and to this country, and they deserve our support. But after their job is done, a lot more will need doing. And for this, the expertise, experience, and the legitimacy of the UN is critical to the success of what the U.S. hopes to achieve.
1-800-423-8255. Sonny, thanks for that. Let's go to San Francisco. Dave's on the line. Hi, Dave.
Hey, folks. I'm sure there's going to be many connections about this, because certainly the charge is going to be leveled, and the likelihood is possible that American corporations and carpetbaggers will be coming in. They may have already made plans to divide up Iraq. People on the streets have been saying no blood for oil, no blood for water, no blood for...
Dave, let me just interrupt you for a minute, because you're talking about... a number of the accusations that have been made about General Jay Garner. He has business interests in the United States. Daniel Serwer, does that cripple him when he goes in to take care of political affairs?
I don't think so. We all have some personal interests one way or another. And the notion that the United States is in favor of dividing Iraq is simply wrong. The United States is a kind of diehard advocate of territorial integrity and sovereignty for Iraq. So far as oil is concerned, I've never understood the arguments of those who say this is all about oil. It seems to me patently the case that that's not true. But oil is a factor in this situation, especially a factor in the prosperity of Iraq post-conflict.
But doesn't that argue for greater transparency and U.S. hands off the administration of that oil in order, if for only this reason alone, to make the case that it's not about oil, that it is about the country and its people?
I would imagine it argues that there should be transparency, and I think the administration has indicated quite clearly that there will be transparency. It also argues for turning over disposition of the oil to Iraqis as quickly as possible.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Dave, thanks for that. Next to Iowa City, Iowa, Shree's with us. Hi, Shree.
Hi. Good morning and a great program. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
My question is actually a bit a different angle, and I'm really worried about the reconstruction program or the plan that we have in place. And I would like Mr. Daniel to answer this if possible. Has he seen anything with regards to the contribution from the other countries in the so-called coalition of willing in terms of the monetary resources? Is it that the American taxpayer will end up paying for all the costs? Or is it that any other nation, if at all, is contributing in terms of monetary resources? And
let's just take that, Daniel.
I think it's unclear. I think the American taxpayer, the supplemental does not even include the costs of reconstruction. So we don't even know what the Americans are going to ante up. We certainly don't know what other members of the coalition of the willing are going to ante up. I do think that that it would be desirable to have more countries contribute. The question is, what are they going to ask in return? And I'm not sure what that is yet. If they're going to ask in return that that they have as strong a role as the Americans in the governance of Iraq post-conflict, I think that the administration is going to study that deal very hard before it thinks about accepting it.
I think the ultimate measure of success here is not going to be what we do, really, but what the Iraqi people are able to do on their own behalf. And for this, they really need the help of outsiders, both in cash and in kind. Now, what are the best mechanisms for organizing that help? In part, I think, as Dan said, at least initially in the aftermath of the conflict, when it's very clear that Saddam Hussein and the Ba'athist regime has been defeated, and they admit the same, that the process begin rapidly and that security be established under the United States. But simultaneously, the plans have to begin to work on welfare, the well-being of the Iraqi people and justice and sort of the whole political framework that's necessary for this country to succeed on its own terms. Organizing much of that will require lots of money, and helping the Iraqi people succeed will require lots of money. And I think the UN provides a way to help organize the effort and the cash necessary to succeed.
Shree, just set aside the money side of it from your perspective and tell me whether or not you think it's an organization like the UN that is best able to do this sort of work, or whether or not the U.S. needs to take the lead.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there is no question about the credibility that the UN can carry out this in a much better and impartial way than any other institution or country for that matter. And just with regard to the last caller that we heard from Virginia, who, if any American or anybody doubts that UN is capable of doing this, then it is, I think, mere ignorance on our part with regards to the world affairs or the other things that UN is carrying out throughout the world. So, I mean, there's no absolutely doubt that UN is and has to be the key player. I'm only worried that will UN have the resources if America backs out as we are so used to doing.
Let me, if I can, turn to Daniel just on the point that you're making, Sri, about impartiality. Even if the UN is slow to move and doesn't bring power with the barrel of a gun, is the impartiality that Sri's talking about a reasonable balance to either of those?
I think it could be quite important in some areas, like humanitarian relief and refugees, things of that sort. But I don't think the Americans are going to have fought this war. They fought it for what they regarded as their vital interests. And they're not going to give up those vital interests once they succeed. They're going to remain attached to those vital interests. And it seems to me neutrality is not what the United States is going to be looking for, at least in the immediate aftermath of the war. What it's going to be looking for is an Iraqi administration that can definitively reject the Saddam Hussein regime. And if the UN were to go in there, I think that's right. The tendency of the UN is towards neutrality. And that's not what the Americans are looking for. And I don't think they'll welcome it.
I don't think that's actually this is the right setting at all to talk about the traditional impartiality and neutrality of what have been in the past, so-called Chapter 6 peacekeeping operations that the UN has mounted on behalf of the member states. This can be altogether a different set of circumstances. This is an effort to help create a capable society, a society where security, well-being, and justice is available to all of Iraqi citizens, where there's representative governance, market economic activity, and the robust civil society based on the rule of law.
Jane, I'm going to stop you there, and we'll pick this up when we come back after the break. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. Listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. With me on the program, Daniel Serwer. He's director of the U.S. Institute for Peace's Balkans Initiative. He's currently researching post-war Iraq's reconstruction needs. And Jane Hall-Lute is also with us. She's Executive Vice President, Chief Operating Officer of the United Nations Foundation, formerly Executive Director of the Carnegie Commission on Preventing Deadly Conflict. These two know a lot about what happens in countries after the guns are at least starting to cool off. Jane, I want to ask you about a feature of the UN that we haven't talked about. We've talked about the weight or the value of its impartiality, either to observer countries or to the Iraqis or to the United States. But you've heard the accusations being made about the French and the Germans and the Russians all saying, hey, we want to get the UN back in there. And it seems to me that their motivation is equally suspect. Partly they're interested in bringing focus back to the UN after the failure of the Security Council last time around, but also maybe they have corporate interests that they want to make sure are looked after in Iraq. So, I mean, everybody here has kind of can be looked at through a tainted glass, no?
Well, isn't that right? One of the things I think that the UN provides is a transparent and accountable forum for these great power interests, this pushing and pulling between Paris and London and Washington and Moscow. It provides a forum for this pushing and pulling and these debates to happen in public view. I mean, it's not too long ago, many of us remember, and many of our parents remember, when these kinds of issues were decided in back rooms, where napkins, substituted for map sheets, and where the fate of millions was often traded for transient political interests. And what we see now is this dialogue is happening in an accountable, transparent way in the Security Council. So the UN, again, is providing this essential forum so that we, the peoples of the United Nations, have a window into what's going on.
Daniel, what do you think? Do you think the Security Council of the UN sort of limps to the table at this point, given the fact that the Security Council ended up not being a forum where, you know, the final decision on this war was made?
I think it does kind of limp to the table. I don't say it can be excluded by no means, but it does serve some useful purposes, as Jane suggests, though I hasten to add that the most useful meetings of the Security Council I've seen are the ones that occur out of the public eye in informal session. I think the UN has a good deal of problem regaining some credibility with the United States. It may have credibility with others, and that needs to be debated and discussed, perhaps not only in public but also in private, so that the great powers can sort out what the future arrangements will be. I think it's always been the case that when the UN Security Council was divided, the UN was hobbled. Only when it finds unity can it really act. And that unity doesn't exist today.
Let's go to St. Paul, Minnesota. George is on the line. Hi, George.
How you doing? Great show.
Thanks for calling.
Listen, with all due reference and respect for the lady from the UN, I just don't think the UN can do the job she wants it to do.
Why, George?
I lost a very close friend in Srebrenica when the UN was supposedly protecting those people in a safe haven. Without the force that the U.S. brings to this thing, I just think they're never going to get rid of the Baathists without the U.S. arms. They're never going to get rid of the regime without the U.S. arms and the coalition forces. And then when it comes time to distribute food, there's just too many ways that somebody who wanted to could use the food as a weapon, like it's happening in Africa.
Let's stay with your first point, George, because it's a really important one. I know Michael Ignatieff has talked about the U.N.'s ability to keep the peace but not make the peace. And Jane, that's got to be a question that concerns people in New York looking at what the UN has to contribute.
I think that there's no question of that. One of the very tough lessons of the past decade for the UN has been not to take on things for which it is not well suited. The UN itself, under the direction of Secretary General Kofi Annan, conducted a very intensive look at what happened in Srebrenica and what happened in Rwanda, quite frankly, and found a lot to fault with the whole process, not only within the UN, but within the member states that are ultimately responsible for directing the activities of the organization. But really what we need to look at here, you know, is not a model is does the U.S. do this, does the UN do this, but how to divide responsibilities along functional comparative advantage so those things for which the UN is well suited, it is asked to do because it has the legitimacy of the world in for many of those functions.
George, back to you.
Yeah, that sounds all well and good. I have never seen it happen without, the force that a coalition could bring. And after the peace
Does it have to be, George, a coalition? Does it have to be someone other than just one country, be it the United States or Britain or the French or whoever? I mean, is that an important part of it?
It has to be someone, quite frankly, other than, in my opinion, the UN, which I know Jane has just talked about the self-introspection they did after Srebrenica, but that's the first time I've heard of it. No one in the UN actually stood up and said, we goofed, we blew it, a whole catastrophe happened in Srebrenica, and we're never going to let that happen again. That never happened. And the people of the world look at that and they say, UN, you just can't keep this peace. You won't have the force.
Yeah, the only thing I would say is that the Secretary General was quite frank and quite open in accepting responsibility, including his own personal responsibility for the positions he held at the time. But the broader question is, you know, there's no debate in my view that the importance of establishing a safe and secure environment to operate in post-war Iraq is essential and that the coalition forces are best suited to do that. But force cannot do all that needs doing to rebuild Iraq to a capable society. And for that, we need other functions, political, economic, and social. And for that, we need the help of others, and the UN is an important part of that help.
Dick, I wonder if I could jump in here just on this particular point.
Yeah, Daniel, go ahead.
It seems to me that the more disorderly the post-conflict situation is, and it could be quite disorderly. We've seen a kind of stay-behind, unconventional warfare operation going on already, and that could continue. It could continue even after we take Baghdad. The more you have that kind of problem, it seems to me the more you have to rely on the coalition military forces in the immediate post-conflict period. There simply is nobody else to do this job.
And does the scale and the size factor into this? I mean, you were making the point earlier that this isn't East Timor. It's not Kosovo. It's a country that's much bigger and much more heavily.
Well, and in fact, I was going to point out that the UN in Kosovo has done what many of us regard as a relatively good job. But the fact is, it's taken years to get control of the former guerrillas, and we still don't have full control of them, largely because the mission is split between civilians and military. The military forces aren't being used as effectively as, or were not used as effectively as they might have been to repress the guerrilla forces and on both sides that were still present in Kosovo after NATO entered. Now, Kosovo is 2 million people. Iraq is maybe 23, 24 million people. This is a colossally big job. And the more disorder there is after the victory, the more the coalition forces are going to have to hold on to authority for a while in order to prepare the way for something else. And when that something else comes, it seems to me clear that the repression of guerrillas or other forms of resistance inside Iraq is going to be more effective if it's in Iraqi hands than it's if it's in any foreign hands.
All right. That's thanks to George for that call from St. Paul. To Beaufort, South Carolina now. Chris is with us. Hello, Chris.
Hello.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Yeah, I was wondering, how do you think the Iraqi people are going to trust the UN, seeing as how they didn't back the U.S. and liberate in their own country, you know? And I think that's a vital point because, you know, if you don't want to liberate a country, then why, you know, why would you want that, you know, the UN to come in and try to maintain that country? I mean, it doesn't make any sense.
And it's certainly the case that based on what limited information we're getting from the Iraqi people at this point, there's not a great open welcome saying thanks for the liberation, but rather questions about just exactly what the U.S. is doing in there. Jane, I want you to talk to Chris on this one here, and perhaps you can by picking up what Daniel was saying, that, you know, even if it's a frightfully messy situation when something else comes along and the transfer is made, what is it that the Iraqi people are going to be looking for? Are they looking for their own people first? Are they looking for the neutrality of the UN first? How do they see that?
And there was an old phrase that we used to hear when we were looking at the transitioning states of Eastern Europe, which was nothing about us without us. And this was an important sentiment that people take very seriously.
Say that again. I missed it. Nothing?
Nothing about us without us. So there's a sense that people, there's a very deep-seated conviction in the belief in self-determination and in the notion that people will have a voice and a right to a say in how they are governed. And this is really the only point I would say in response to Dan, what Dan has been saying. I absolutely agree about the security question, but we don't have the luxury of sort of getting that fully in place and then moving on to the next challenge, which might be the political structure or the economic structure. These things happen simultaneously. So there's a necessary codependency of these operations, militarily stabilizing the situation, to be sure. But that stabilization and transition to a normal, functioning, capable Iraqi society will only happen with economic and political progress that the Iraqi people themselves have to take hold of. And here, international oversight, management, and help will be essential. I think coming to the caller's question about the Iraqi sentiment, does it favor the UN and international community, or does it favor the U.S.? I mean, quite frankly, the international community, as the American people, are themselves quite divided over this military effort. While most Americans pretty clearly support the soldiers, many believe that, you know, the half of us, apparently on the eve of war, believe that we should be doing this in the company of others and not going it alone. Well, we are where we are. And the question is, as we look forward, what will be the best for the Iraqi people and the international community, the U.S., its coalition partners, and the U.N. need to get its collective act together. And again, success will be measured not by what we do, but on what the Iraqi people are able to do on their own behalf.
Daniel, you've worked as a diplomat. You've been in the State Department. So you're very familiar with the U.N. and what it can do. How would you nail down the one failing that the UN has? What's the one thing that's wrong with the organization now for moving in more quickly the way that you're cautioning perhaps it ought not to do?
It's limited standby capacity is the main issue. I mean, you just
lack of money? I'm sorry, standby capacity.
No,
what do you
standby
mean?
Capacity in the sense of, in particular, personnel to do some of these jobs. The UN, if it's going to mount a police monitoring task force, for example, which is one possible need in Iraq, has to start from scratch each time, basically. And there's very little in the way of a headquarters capability. There's much more than there once was, but there's very, very limited headquarters capability. Basically, each of these UN missions is built from the ground up, from scratch. And there's some limited planning, but it's nothing like the planning that Jay Garner, for example, is engaged in right now. The UN can't begin to plan until it has some authority, unless it does it sort of on the sly, which I suspect some of them are doing. But there's no standby capacity for these operations.
Help me,
Janet.
That
seems to me, aside from the humanitarian area, where, of course, there is some standby capacity, but for governance, there's no standby capacity.
Just look at the numbers with me, Jane. There may be, within a matter of weeks, 300,000 soldiers in Iraq ready to enforce a peace there. Would the UN even want to try and, mount the sort of assistance for civil administration in a hurry there?
I don't think anybody wants to do anything in a hurry. I think that if the UN has a failing right now or a shortcoming, it's really the lack of imagination on the part of its member states for what the organization can best be used for. Again, the troops from the United States, the UK, and its coalition partners will provide the essential security, mm-hmm. but it will take a sizable presence over a long term to do that, and they're positioned and well-trained. And interested, as Dan said, in seeing that succeeds. But pretty soon, almost immediately, you need the kinds of political engagement, economic engagement, and social engagement to ensure that the Iraqi citizens can succeed on their own terms. And for this expertise and experience and legitimacy, the UN is an unparalleled source in the service of the United States, its coalition partners, and all the world states.
We will talk more about this. I'm absolutely sure of that. Jane, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Jane Hall-Lute is Executive Vice President, Chief Operating Officer of the United Nations Foundation. Daniel Serwer, thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
Daniel's Director of the U.S. Institute for Peace's Balkans Initiative. We talked earlier in the program with Karen Sloan. She's a reporter with the Associated Press at Central Command Headquarters in Doha, Qatar, and with Colin Soloway, a Newsweek correspondent embedded with the 101st Airborne Division. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
To purchase CDs or cassettes of The Connection, please visit us online at theconnection.org or call 1-800-909-9287.